Hello, everyone, and welcome to Talk Nerdy. Today is Monday, November 16th, 2020, and I'm the host of the show, Cara Santa Maria. And in American political news, I mean, unless you've been living under a rock, you probably know by now that the election results, for the most part, are in. Joe Biden has been named the next president of the United States. So all I will say about that is that the guy I was hoping would win, and of course the incredible woman, Kamala Harris, will be serving as Veep. The guy I was hoping would disappear is still trying to fight this thing, but he doesn't have an argument to be made. So a weight has been lifted. We'll talk a little bit more about some of the concepts of divisiveness, but we'll be getting more into conspiratorial thinking and pseudoscience in this episode. And it's just like a really fascinating chat. It's a really good one, you guys. But before we do that, I do want to thank those of you who continue to support the show week after week. You know that I have a Patreon account, patreon.com/talknerdy. And that's where you can pledge to support even a dollar an episode. It goes an awfully long way. But of course, I want to give a shout out to the top supporters of the show because they have just made incredible contributions that we can all appreciate. This is how I keep my show free. That includes Michael Gaucher, Mary Neva, Christopher Pitts, June Sapara, Pasquale Gelati, Ulrika Hagman, Dudas Infinitas, Charles Payet, Brian Holden, Pedro M. Rosario Barbosa, Daniel Lang, David J. E. Smith, Robert Christ, and Elise Christie. Thank you all so, so, so much. All right, so I kind of gave you a little preview, but this is an interesting episode this week because I had the opportunity to chat with somebody that I went to school with, like high school with. So we've known each other for ages. And of course, you know, through life's twists and turns, moved to other places, did other things, and happened to reconnect actually at a AAAS conference earlier this year, where I learned a little bit more about the incredible work that she's doing now. So we decided to get together for a chat remotely, of course, COVID safe. And I'm just super into like the topics that we talked about. I think it's going to be really illuminating for you guys. So her name is Dr. Ashley Landrum, and she is an assistant professor of science communication in the College of Media and Communication at Texas Tech University. So without any further ado, here she is, Dr. Ashley Landrum. Ashley, thank you so much for joining me today.
Yeah, thank you.
I am so glad that we finally worked this out. Okay, this is such a weird and fun thing. So we went to high school together
yep.
Like forever ago. And who knew? So we were in a lot of like gifted and talented classes together, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
That's kind of how we knew each other.
Yeah, definitely. That and just even our friend group, I think, my high school boyfriend at the time, you know, Nathan Stein, who actually went and got his PhD at Harvard. But at the time he was in a punk band. And I think that, you used to go to those concerts too, right?
Oh yes. And also I had known Nathan since elementary school.
Right, 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 right.
Because like we grew up together. I went to his bar mitzvah. Oh my gosh, I forgot that you dated Nathan. I love him. He's a brilliant guy. Probably one of the smartest kids at our school, I think.
Oh yeah. Hands down.
Yeah, yeah, like, brilliant.
This, yeah,
and brilliant in one of those cool ways where like he was intellectually brilliant, but also socially brilliant. Like he had interpersonal skills, and like he was a punk rocker.
Yes,
which is not common. And you, of course, were a ballet dancer.
Yeah, 18 years of it, or something like that. And then I quit to, you know, get a real job, basically one that will go past age 40.
Right. That's the thing. I have actually a very dear friend who dances. She's the assistant to Talk Nerdy. And so anybody who's interacted with her knows her. Noelle. Hi, Noelle. Thank you. And she still dances, and it's, you know, it's a part of her career, but she has a multifaceted career. And it's so, yeah, you have to, because she's, I mean, I hate to say this because Noelle, you're young and beautiful and I love you. But in terms of the dance world, she's old.
Yeah, no. And one of my best friends, she went on to dance professionally after college. You know, she went to Indiana, which has a fantastic ballet program. Then she went to dance for a company in Colorado. And I mean, I'm pretty sure she's had hip replacements already. It's like,
oh, God.
You know, we haven't hit our midlife point yet. And you know, that it's so rough on your body. But yeah, I originally, you know, when I went to college, I thought, oh, well, you know, nobody understands dancers' bodies. So I'm going, you know, because I would hurt myself, right? Because everybody does. And then I would go to physical therapy and they would try to build up my muscles in a way consistent with, like, you know, some 50-year-old tennis player as opposed to, you know, a ballet dancer. Like, you don't build you build your, you know, your inner thigh and it just and assorted things like that. So I was like, oh, I'm going to go to medical school and I'm going to treat dancers. And then, of course, it just went on a huge tangent from there.
And then you fell in love with science.
Yes, yes. Yeah, I loved it. And my chemistry professor, so I went to UT Austin, and we had 500 people in my intro chemistry class. And he was so funny. He said, it was Dave Loudy. And he said, okay, how many? He's like, look to your right. And he goes, how many of you think you're going to medical school? You know, like yeah. All 500 people, like the only reason that class has 500 people in it is because all those like freshmen who think they're going to go to medical school, he goes, look to your right, look to your left. None of the three of you are going to medical school. And then he went on to explain, he wasn't saying, oh, medical school is too hard for you to do. He said, there's so many more interesting things to do with your life. And when you're coming from high school, all you know about is like, I'm going to be a doctor. I'm going to be a lawyer. I'm going to be a police officer. Like, you know, if it was like a Lego guy, you knew about the career. But other than that, and you know, he was totally right. I was taking classes in, you know, in philosophy and I took a whole class on Robin Hood. You know, I mean, there's so many kind of neat things out there. And so I
ended up... Was that like an economics class or a philosophy class?
No, it was an English class in the so it was all in Old English. So like the there's like a Chaucer class and a Robin Hood class, and it was really neat.
That's cool.
You know, random stuff. I think at UT at the time you could major in didgeridoo too. So I mean, there's just all sorts of stuff that you just wouldn't know about. You know, that you could do with your life. And so I definitely had a very interdisciplinary undergraduate degree. And you know, that was very science involved, but even the philosophy classes I was taking were all about, you know, like judgment and decision making and, you know, how emotions influence the way that we think. And because, I mean, this goes back to from high school, like I never understood why people would believe bullshit, right? Why do people believe bullshit? And more like, why can't, you know, if you have evidence, why can't you explain to somebody, you know, what's true, why won't they accept it? And so I studied that from a philosophy perspective. I studied that from, you know, a neurobio. I went and got my master's degree in cognition and neuroscience, and then my PhD in psychology, but it was like all looking at the same question. And then I realized, you know, that, well, and then I sort of focused in on the issue of science specifically. And science is more interesting, I think, than politics, because you can understand that people have different perspectives, they have different, you know, views. People can want to, you know, they can have things that are clearly like, it's not always 100% certain what the best thing to do is, but you might weigh, you know, government regulation over, you know, economic stimulus. Like there's a variety of different things that you might think work and can lead to different political views. But when it comes to science, it's like, well, I mean, you have this huge pile of evidence that suggests something. So why don't you accept that?
It's interesting when there's kind of like this calculus that we have to make in life. And a lot of that calculus is constructed. A lot of it is subjective. A lot of it is all about how we prioritize our interests and our morals. That is really philosophy, psychology, even economics to some extent, political science. But you're right. When it comes especially to what we think of as sort of the sciences that get closer and closer to the models of the universe that we've been able to approximate. So like mathematics, maybe like core physics, chemistry, even certain aspects of biological sciences, and then moving on to environmental sciences and things like that. We have these pretty distinct models. And so you can like look at this pile of evidence, like you said, that has been iterated. And not just iterated, but iterated by like hundreds of thousands of people over the years, right, and say, okay, I'm going to agree with the experts to the extent that I cognitively am capable of doing that. But there are people that go, expertise in this aspect does not fit with my worldview. I shall ignore it.
Right. Yeah. And that's a thing. And I think that was, it was weird how, you know, even like halfway through a PhD program, you'd expect somebody to have a lot of knowledge, but I feel like I was very naive because I didn't really see that. And I think at some point halfway through, it really clicked that, you know, it's an issue of trust. We're balancing trust and expertise. And the thing is like, you know, even, you know, I know we might get to this a little bit later. I spent time interviewing flat earthers.
Yes.
You don't have the background knowledge to understand the math, right? So mm-hmm. I mean, there are equations that can be used to show you that the Earth is curved. Everything else, you are relying on what you've learned from other people. It could technically can all be fake. I mean, I've seen the movie Gravity. I've seen Armageddon. You know, I know that Hollywood is capable of you know, duplicating an environment that looks like space. And so I could easily, if I had that sort of worldview or that conspiratorial worldview where I just don't think it happened, I can just reject any picture that I've seen, any, you know, testimony, because that's all it is testimony. And testimony can always be dismissed when you think that the person giving it is not credible. And so without the mathematical knowledge to understand the, you know, the proofs of the shape of the Earth, or the trust in other people in our world, you can see how it could be very easy to believe in something that's not true.
Absolutely. And I think that this honestly is one of the biggest shortcomings that I see within the scientific skeptic community. Is one of the conversations that's not had often enough is the conversation about trust, belief, faith, acceptance of authority. Because I think what's often the rhetoric that you hear is don't trust, don't believe, independently verify, independently understand. And that, although that is a very noble and I think important goal, the truth has to lie somewhere in the middle. You cannot, no one person can independently verify anything, everything, nor are they capable of it from an expertise standpoint. Like you said, you know, most people don't have the basic fundamental expertise to read source scientific articles.
And they shouldn't have to. Yeah.
I mean, and nor should they have to, because they didn't dedicate their lives to that. It's not because they're not smart enough. It's literally because they trained in something else. They put all of their effort into something else.
Exactly. Yeah. We only have so much time, you know, available that we have to choose what we're experts in. And, no, but that's definitely true. And that was sort of the realization that I had in grad school. And I became really interested in studying conspiracy theories in particular, because we spent, you know, my PhD was in developmental psychology and specifically looking at how children learn to trust others as experts, but also like when knowing when to doubt, right? And so my grad advisor published this paper called Knowing When to Doubt. But I kept thinking like, well, the first line we wrote in almost every single one of these papers was some iteration of, you know, we can't trust everything you hear, right? Like, don't be gullible. You know, how do children learn how not to be gullible? But I think we're really good at not being gullible. We're really bad at knowing when to trust and when just to like defer to expert, like when to trust information. I mean, the exact lines that you're saying are sort of, parables in some ways of the skeptic community. Those are the same that you hear in the conspiratorial community, you know, research it yourself, do it yourself. And
like most of the conspiratorial underpinnings are not, I believe everything I'm told. They are, I don't trust the powers that be. And because I don't trust people who are in power, I'm now going to turn to what I think is sort of the only truth, or, you know, it's some sort of like special group that I'm in who knows the real truth. And that's where I'm going to put my faith.
And half the time there's not a cohesive belief system that's accepted by the conspiracy theorists themselves. The only thing that they believe is that the main story is not true. And there's a paper published that I think gets misinterpreted often when it's discussed. And the title of it is called Dead or Alive. And it showed that that people who would endorse the idea that Princess Diana is actually still alive would also equally endorse the idea that Queen Elizabeth specifically had her killed. And they were like, they're clearly, conspiracy theorists clearly aren't rational. They hold these two conflicting beliefs. But they're missing A, the way the question was asked, and B, conspiracy theorists are really being said, which is conspiracy theorists will think any story that's not the main one are probably true. One of those is likely to be true, but it's definitely not the real story.
Right. So it's not so much that they're like, both of these things are true at the same time. No. It's that they're like, these are equally plausible in my eyes because what is being told to me by the powers that be must be a lie.
Exactly. And even when I was talking to the flat earthers, I mean, there were disagreements about, you know, what the mental model of the earth really was. I mean, there were some, you know, lines that they were repeating, you know, that are pretty common, but they were like, and that may not even be true because we don't know and we're still investigating it. And in some ways they're using the language from the scientific community of, you know, oh, well, we're still trying to figure that out. They don't have to be, you know, 100% committed to a specific mental model the way we expect other areas of science denial, or the way that we've seen other areas of science denial. Like, intelligent design, for example, has a very specific, you know, sort of mental model of how, you know, humanity happened, or, you know, how the universe was created. But the flat earthers weren't necessarily like that. They differed. The only thing that they 100% agreed on was what you're being told is fake. So
yeah, and it's almost like the agenda behind the reasoning is different, right? There's sort of the paranoia or the fear of the new world order. This is a common thing you hear about. I think you see this with QAnon quite a lot. You see it even sometimes with climate denial. I just, for another podcast, had to watch Climate Hustle too, and it was really painful. And that was like their big thesis statement was that there's this like global cabal that wants to take over and create a global government. And really it's all starting with a global economy. And that is the green movement. But I think that outside of that sort of fear of a new world order, what you see is that there are certain anti-science movements that have a clear-cut political agenda that has been orchestrated. It's agenda driven. There are literally people who are like writing policy behind it. You're getting ALEC legislation, and you're getting, you know, individuals who have made this part of their strategy. And then people glom onto it. And then there is this sort of Alex Jones style conspiratorial thinking, which is all just about not trusting whoever's in charge.
Yeah. No, and in that way, like, you can look at, you know, climate denial compared to, you know, the flat earth movement. And, if you read Naomi Oreskes' book, right, they talk very clearly about how PR was involved in, you know, structuring this. And then you, like you said, right, the sort of the skeleton of that belief system was built on purpose. And then on top of it, you get, you know, the masses of people who accept it because of either who's messaging it or because of, you know, what else it's sort of connected with kind of come. But then you have those sort of from the floor up, or from the ground up, you know, local movements that just become very widespread. And it's just like, how do you handle this? And that sort of,
I know it all feels very big because it's not one thing. And I think sometimes we wish, or we want it to be one thing where it's like conspiracy theorists or pseudoscientists or people who believe in pseudoscientists, they're just all like X. And if we can just solve X, then everything, like, you know, knowledge deficit, like that's where you get the knowledge deficit argument. Right. Like, let's just teach them more stuff. And once they know real stuff, they'll forget all the fake stuff. And it's
like, you know, so knowledge deficit, right? That's one of like the original theories relevant to science comm that has been debunked over and over. But not, I think that there's also sort of two schools on this. It's not that, you know, teaching people is not helpful. It's that,
of course, yeah, it's part of the problem.
There's always going to be a positive, you know, relationship between education and you know, believing true things. But the problem is when that's interacted upon by values, previous beliefs, you know, cultural worldviews, like, and knowledge doesn't help attenuate that in many cases. So you end up, you know, in some cases, like some of the work I've done with Dan Kahan on climate change beliefs, you know, sometimes you'll see that, you know, people who are more politically conservative, there's absolutely like no change in acceptance of climate change based on knowledge. In other cases, in some data collections that we've done, you actually see where people who have more knowledge, either science knowledge generally or climate change specific knowledge, are even less likely to accept that climate change is real and human caused. And so you see sort of,
and
this,
they're just better at arguing their case now because they're exactly. armed with like with the facts that they're able to now use to right, you know, exactly. use to whatever end they want to use them right. to.
And you could argue that if they were true, like, you know, the Plato definition of true knowledge, right, on something yeah. like that, you know, of course they would accept it, but the proportion of people, you know, to the rest of society that are going to have that type of knowledge, it's just going to be these like real high level experts. And you're not going to be able to like apply that to society as a whole. So the real, you know, kind of the real method is not, I mean, yes, we still have to improve education. We have to find great ways to teach these things. But at the same time, we also have to find ways to message about this that uses motivated reasoning for good, right? So
yeah,
people are motivated reasoners. So how do we sort of, you know, take what the natural process of human cognition is and use it to get, you know, to get people to sort of evaluate information in ways that are consistent with what's reality.
So I have a question for you, I guess, kind of like before we get into some of the interesting findings that you've had in your papers and definitely like some of the solutions that you've been able to find, because it's great to sit around and dissect why people believe what they believe and why, you know, otherwise really intelligent people can believe in bullshit. But it's, and we need to understand that, but it's a little bit depressing unless we also are investigating how to affect change in that area. But yeah. Before we get into that, I guess I have a question for you simply about knowledge and about increasing knowledge. So, and I'm kind of developing this question as I talk, so apologies if I talk around it for a minute. There's obviously going to be a big difference between if somebody who has a hard line belief, like I believe the Earth is 6,000 years old, let's say, if you give them one scientific paper and say, look, it's obvious the Earth is not 6,000 years old. We did some radiocarbon dating on these rocks. They're way older than that. And they have this one paper and obviously their mind's not going to be changed. But if somebody who believes the Earth is 6,000 years old, leaves high school and enters into an academic environment for four solid years and is training in geology, for example, it's much more likely, I would think, unless there's a personality block that's not allowing for it or their beliefs really are that hard-lined, that they're going to start accepting certain truths simply because they're getting evidence over and over and over and over and over and they're, you know, curating a worldview. So number one is, you know, a university education significantly effective in helping to, I guess, fight against some of these conspiracy or pseudoscientific views. But number two, do people on the pseudoscientific side of the argument see that as sort of liberal indoctrination?
Yeah, so this is rough, right?
Right.
So first, I would say that, you know, a university education is not monolithic, right?
You can so true. You can go to Liberty University too,
right? But even so, Texas Tech, where I am now, it probably leans a bit more conservative in terms of, you know, its student body and maybe some of the faculty. But we still have, you know, people complain about like liberal indoctrination. But you know, students can come in and they can major in business, they can major in engineering, they can major in, you know, advertising, PR. And I don't think that they'll ever really find themselves facing, or at least not with any sort of regularity, anything that would challenge some of the world beliefs that people are concerned with.
Right.
And really, I think when people talk about liberal indoctrination in universities, what I think they really mean is sociology. Like, you know, if you major in sociology, you might be exposed to some of these more liberal or more progressive, even in some cases, progressive for liberals, you know, viewpoints. But I think that it's, I think it's very problematic that, you know, that universities have been described in this way. But that's teaching
climate change, right. Or I think that's been like one of the, sorry to interrupt, but I think that's been one of the big problems is that, like, you know, you and I went to high school in Texas. We lived in an affluent community where we were able to get by all comparative standards, a very good education. But even in our, you know, incredible privilege, I don't remember. Or I remember taking history classes and being taught that the Civil War, that the Civil War was about economic disagreements, right? And like I don't remember ever having a professor or a teacher that was like overtly saying, you know, no, the South wanted to keep their slaves. Like there was no sort of like, that wasn't even, I don't think, in our textbooks.
Yeah.
And that's part of the problem.
I started off in you know, an area less affluent than Plano originally. So mm-hmm. I was in Louisville, Texas, or Flower Mound, Texas. And then I moved to Plano, Texas, right before eighth grade. And so, I mean, I remember talking about slavery and how slavery was bad, and how slavery was part of the Civil War. I don't remember if we talked about that much in school. But like, I also remember learning, for example, that condoms don't prevent against AIDS because AIDS virus is smaller than the pores of a condom.
So OMG.
Like, yeah. I mean, I remember learning all sorts of things like where we shouldn't use tampons because like if the blood is sitting, I mean, you know, and this was all like we had sex ed, but there was, and you know, I don't know that this was, you know, propaganda from, you know, the school district or if this was just nurses that were teaching these classes who just really didn't know. Like, it could
It's hard to know when you're in a place where there's, you know, a school board that's trying to suppress certain things from being written in textbooks, but also on average, the person you meet on the street or the teacher or the whatever in the classroom, unfortunately, might be living within a specific worldview that's less
right. Exactly. One of my graduate students, you know, he did his dissertation on high school teachers teaching about climate change, and you know whether they felt supported, what their views on it were, if they felt like they were knowledgeable enough to be actually communicating mm-hmm. that information, because you know you have people, and in, especially when it comes to science and mathematics, you know, and while there are programs that have trained teachers in science education, there's a lot of schools that have teachers who are teaching science because that was the job that was available. And they maybe had to answer some questions or they had to take a subject matter test, but they really weren't trained in it. And they don't feel prepared to teach some of these things. They have platforms where they're teaching these students and, you know, they very well may be miscommunicating or, you know, communicating misinformation.
Yeah. And not even intentionally. Yeah.
But they are trained teachers. On the other hand, you have people at university who are not trained educators, but we're trained in our topic area. And so whether we're good or not at communicating, that is a whole nother issue.
True.
But, you know, kind of going back to your other point, I think if a student is sort of open to wanting to study something like geology, right, or atmospheric science, or, you know, maybe they find themselves taking biology classes and, you know, if they're open to it and they start studying it, then they might find themselves changed. And I think it's an open question whether their minds are changing because they're being exposed to evidence. An interaction effect, right? On one hand, they're being exposed to a lot of information that tells them why you should believe this. Like, why is carbon dating something we trust? It's not just a name. It's not just a terminology. that's easy to dismiss if you don't know what it is, but this is how this works and why we should trust it. But they're also surrounded by peers and people that they might look up to. And so you have a whole social network that supports the acceptance of these views too. And in some ways you do have your own little kind of like, you know, pro-geology echo chamber that you're learning.
Yeah. And that's so important. Like I remember when I quit smoking, the first thing, and this was 10 years ago now, the first thing that I sort of told myself and was told by other people who had long quit was like, you can't even just have one and you really can't hang out with smokers. Like it's going to be impossible for you to stay quit if you're surrounding yourself with other smokers. And it's such a clear and obvious thing when you're talking about breaking bad habits, right? Like you want to quit doing drugs, you're not going to hang out with your drug friends anymore. Or you need to quit drinking, you're not going to go party with all your friends who get drunk on the weekends all the time. But it's the same principle when it comes to worldviews.
Yeah. And I had one of the women who was a postdoc with me at Annenberg Public Policy Center said that she grew up a hardcore creationist and she went to college in Washington and took some philosophy classes. And what was funny is I found out that some of the philosophy classes she took was from another friend of mine. So we've all stayed.
Weird.
You know, we get close in age sometimes, right? She found herself like she would get in screaming matches with some of her philosophy professors when they would talk about things like, you know, creation or, you know, creation myths and earth and the age of the earth, like, cause the stuff is talked about in some philosophy courses. And she said, eventually she started, you know, she would be making these intellectual arguments and she found that her mind was changed over time. But she put herself in those situations. There's, you know, going to be a lot of students who won't, you know, they're not going to take, you know, philosophy classes. They're not going to take, you know, gender studies. They're not going to expose themselves. You have to select to expose yourself to some of those courses. And there are people who do. And you know, there are different perspectives. There's a lot of things I think that are up for debate in our social world. You know, as we talk about, you know, well, for example, in media communication, we have, you know, we sort of have like three kind of routes of methods and research design. Okay. We talk about people who do like quantitative research, who are really looking at, you know, what can we say is true about a population, right? What generalizes to a population? And then you have...
Like we'll give a bunch of people a survey or some sort of exam or some sort of test. And we'll look at all the total responses and say, generally speaking, people do X, Y, and Z.
Yeah, exactly. Like, or you can say, you know, as a population, like this is true. Yeah. Then you have, you know, work that might be a bit more qualitative, which is, you know, really in depth digging into things that may not be true for the whole population, but may be true for that group. So if we do, for example, like a focus group to talk about women's reasons for engaging with digital video, because that's something I'm a little interested in right now, you know, because we have a huge gender gap in engagement with digital video. You know, the women in the room will tell us, oh, this is what I do, this is what I do. And that might give us ideas and, you know, for testing on a you know, on a larger scale, but we can't say that's true of everybody, right? We're like learning maybe what possible different views are. And then there's kind of another area which looks at maybe not a variety of different possible views, but they'll say, is it possible to perceive it as this, right? So could you see the world in this way? Or maybe you didn't think about seeing the world in this way. And I think this is the area of research that gets really muddled in society, because it's you know, the researchers who are being, you know, who are working with integrity will say, you know, this is a perspective. Like I'm elucidating a perspective for you. You know, people could watch, you know, this movie and feel this from this, or they could have this reaction to this. And I think the rest of the world who's used to hearing results from generalizable studies or studies that purport to be generalizable think that they're saying everybody sees something that way. I think that's sort of a misunderstanding of kind of the different levels of research. You know, can something be true, you know, what might different people be saying and what as a population is happening. Like those are different sort of different things. And I think
right.
Like,
and what's so easy to us is you're looking at like the full text of an article and it's, you know, this is a 2x2 design, you know, you don't even say quantitative. You'll say this is a 2x2 design and blah, 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 blah. And you're like, okay, so I know what they did. Or like, this was a phenomenological study. So it's like, okay, so that's qualitative. And like people who do this kind of research can see those key words. But if you're a science journalist, you may not even see the method section. You might just see the press release or read the, you know, or do an interview.
And even if a science journalist is describing it accurately, you know, as a person reading it, you may have an emotional reaction to it, you know?
Yeah.
Like you might say something. So I don't know if you saw recently that Anne Hathaway had apologized for her role in the remake of Roald Dahl's The Witches.
Because, no, I didn't know she apologized. For what?
So I'll say like, I didn't read the article all the way through. So I'm using this as an example, but there was something about her character having like only three fingers on each hand. Or something to that effect. Mm-hmm. And she said that she didn't realize how that might, sort of hurt the feelings of children who have atypical limb formation. Right.
Okay. Yeah.
And now, so you have some people in maybe the bit more conservative community or something saying like, that's a bunch of like woke bullshit. Right. Mm-hmm. Like how many kids have malformed arms that are like crying and are upset about this?
One, I think in her view, she was like, let's make sure that one person realizes that it's not for them or I'm not making fun of them.
No, exactly. And so that's sort of the difference. It's like it is a perspective that could have been taken. I didn't read the story. So I don't know if somebody reached out to her specifically or if she had heard something, but like, a perspective could have been taken, but then the sort of response to it from some people more on the politically conservative side was like, what are you doing? That's crazy, right? Mm-hmm. Because their thought was like, oh, like this whole thing is done because they're assuming all these people are reacting this way. So I think that there's some like miscommunication in there about the like belief that you should make a statement because you don't want one kid to feel bad versus like believing that the whole US feels the, you know, do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah. And that interestingly, the intent or even the action is construed by people with different belief systems as being either permissive or aggressive or virtue signaling or, you know, all these different, like this happens to me an awful lot on social media is that if I write something, like the other day I did a little rant about the word disenfranchised because when Trump, so we're recording this on Saturday, November 7th. So it was just announced this morning that the AP finally called it for Biden. But so far Trump hasn't conceded. It's not likely that he will anytime soon. But, you know, on the night of the election, Trump made a speech basically claiming victory. And he went on to talk about how his own supporters were disenfranchised. And I was offended by that. And so I did a little, and then another friend who's like a good friend of mine, who's not from the US, reached out to ask me some questions. And like, he's like, I'm just trying to understand the worldview of a Trump voter. And I feel like, yeah, they are disenfranchised and blah, blah, blah. And I was like, you are misusing that word. Like I'm realizing that this doublespeak is actually working. So I went on social media and I wrote like, the word disenfranchised literally means to suppress somebody's vote, like to tell them they can't vote. To disenfranchise somebody is to deny them the vote. And historically, women and ethnic minorities, you know, people of color have been disenfranchised. That is not the correct word to describe for the vast majority of Trump supporters. Not saying there aren't people of color that voted for Trump, but the vast majority of Trump supporters have never known what disenfranchisement is. You're thinking of disillusioned. You're thinking of angry about X, Y, and Z, you know, angry about the world changing and their ability to earn a wage, not being as present as it used to be, all these things. And so I post this and there are people who like are like, stop with the virtue signaling. This is like a very common response I get on social media. Like, okay, SJW, stop with the virtue signaling. And it's like, no, I actually legitimately think that this is a terrible rewriting of history and that we need to remember about disenfranchisement. It's an important, you know, atrocity of our history that we need to remember. But a common view that I see sometimes is that even the conversation becomes like a triggering conversation to somebody's worldview. And so it's offensive to them, I suppose.
No, I understand. And I, you know, there people are definitely not using the actual definition of disenfranchisement, but probably like the more colloquial use of like, they feel like they're being deprived of something in some way.
Exactly. Yeah. But like a feeling of being deprived of something and literally being blocked from voting are two very different things.
I will say, and you know, and maybe this is, you know, I mean, yes, I'm liberal. I'm also employed at a university with a high proportion of students who are coming from very rural areas. And, you know,
in Texas.
And, you know, this is not like where we went to high school. You know what I mean? Like this is way much more rural than this. Like, you know, where the closest neighbors that they had were, you know, like a mile or two down the road. But, you know, there are real struggles that some of, you know, like rural white, you know, families do face. You know, one of our students, like I'll sort of give a story here. Like, now I'll say too, like he is very progressive. He votes very liberal, but you could see very easily how he could go the opposite direction, because when he was, you know, wrapping up, well, first, you know, his mom had him when she was like 15 or 14 or something, like really young. He was raised by his grandparents. You know, they didn't see why he needed to go to school. Like it wasn't like, why, you know, he managed to work his way through college. He put himself through grad school. Like that is a feat in of itself. You know, after like kind of this life he's been in, you know, he had no money. And, you know, as he's getting ready to finish and he has to work on his diversity statements for his job, you know, he's basically being told by our faculty, like, you know, be very cognizant when you're writing statements that you are a privileged white male. Mm-hmm. And in his mind, he's thinking like, okay, yes, I'm not likely to get shot by the police if I'm pulled over for a ticket, but look what all of the adversity that I faced growing up, look at everything that I've done, and then to call me privileged, you know, I think that I think it can be very difficult for people who are, you know, in a lower income class who don't, you know, they're seeing their circumstances that they're in as not being great. Like they don't often get to go to college, or they, you know, they don't have the money or the means or even the knowledge about how to apply for certain types of programs. The rural white classes is a sort of a missing audience for science too, or for engagement in STEM. Like these are people who don't often get jobs, but a lot of our STEM based programs that are supposed to broaden participation are aiming for, you know, ethnic minorities or women, and we forget about these like rural white class, you know, white lower class individuals. And so you could see how they do feel in some ways disenfranchised, not with the vote, but, and I just think that's important for us to kind of think about too. It's like, you know, if we want to like actually unite the country, you know, how do we address the issues that they're facing as much as we address the issues of other, you know, other groups that are having issues financially, recognizing they're all coming from different, like, you know, they're not a class that's been oppressed in slavery, you know, but they do face some challenges that are rough.
Of course. And that's where I think the real difficulty with messaging does come in, because you have a group of people, let's say from a feminist perspective, right? That like there are men who go through awful things. There are men, for example, as some of the reason that a lot of men find themselves in the MRA, the men's rights activism movement, is that they went through terrible custody hearings and they ended up not getting the rights to their children that they feel that they deserved simply because the laws favor women. And instead of kind of looking at the big picture and saying, well, the reason the laws favor women is because by and large, you sort of represent an anomalous father that, like, sadly and unfortunately, the vast majority of these cases are cases where the mother is the one who has to take on the child because the father is either deserting or not paying child support or whatever. And so I think it's a similar statement where it's like, maybe the problem here is the messaging. Like we talk about privilege a lot because it's a word that describes something that's well understood by those who understand it. But it's also very triggering to people who are like, wait, I'm not privileged, because what they're not seeing is that, like, yes, you are, even if your life has been really fucking hard. And I think that's the hard thing. Like, privilege doesn't refer to the fact that you never face trials or tribulations or trauma or suffering, but because of the color of your skin, because of the genitals that you own, because of the whatever, you don't have that added burden. And so it's one of those difficult things, because there's a part of me that says, yes, I need to be more understanding, and yes, I need to be more inclusive, and yes, I need, but there's another part of me that goes, but I'm sick of coddling the group of people that actually is perpetuating the problem.
Yeah, well, and yeah, and I think that we might argue too, like, that the people perpetuating the problem may not be those, like, rural voters themselves, but maybe...
No, the people, well, the people voting for the people that are perpetuating the problem.
Yeah. No, yeah. For sure. But, you know, I do think that, you know, words matter.
Yeah.
Think about the connotations with privilege, like, what does it mean to be privileged, and how that would, you know, and you're right, like, you know, there is... yeah, it you know, how do you describe something in a way that sort of, like, helps people better understand? And it's rough.
Yeah, because I do see sometimes that the messaging coming from certain individuals, and I hate to, like, be divisive, but I think the only way to describe this is a divisive one, sort of a libertarian and pseudo-intellectual conservative message that I often see is, like, it's the left that's being divisive. You're the ones who keep talking about slavery. You're the ones who keep talking about race relations. And if we would all just get along, and we would all just stop with the, you know, conversations about affirmative action and the conversations about victimatology, then this wouldn't be an issue. And it's like, no, it's an issue regardless of the fact that we're talking about it. We're talking about it to bring it into the light. And so that's
COVID. If you don't test for COVID, there's not as many.
Yeah. And that's where I start to get frustrated, because although I agree that we have to be smarter with our messaging, and although I absolutely, as a science communicator, don't want to isolate individuals or tell them, you are not worthy of being part of my tribe. You know, I never want somebody who's, like, highly religious or highly conservative to think that science is not available to them as a worldview or as a career opportunity or whatever. But by the same token, I don't want to be tolerant of intolerance.
Right.
And that's the part I struggle with as a psychotherapist. I mean, that's, like, my growing edge, is when I have to work with racist clients or I have to work with sexist clients. I need to have the sort of non-judgmental stance and the sort of love stance towards my clients that I know I struggle with. You know, I think a lot of therapists struggle with that. And so that's, I think, a perfect example of, like, how do we square that circle?
Right. No, I mean, agreed.
yeah, right. It's a tough thing, but it's a big part of, like,
but I, you know,
the edges of what you research.
Right, exactly. And, you know, I think part of it is, you know, maybe not going to come from top down, but, like, a lot of programs, like developing programs for rural communities. And, you know, one thing, like, and this is not popular, but I was complaining to some friends of mine when Amazon was deciding, it was Amazon, right? That was deciding where to put their new headquarters or whatever.
Yeah. Like, and I think Tesla had that issue too, but yeah, it was the Amazon was the big one you're talking about, I think.
I don't, you know what I think would make the world a better place? If people would put these huge, like, corporations in the Rust Belt, you know, put them in middle America. And, like, I have friends who, you know, who live on the coasts, at universities and stuff, who just were shocked when I moved to Texas. They don't know what Texas is, you know, but their view is just terrible. Like, they're like, oh, why would you want to live there? And
yeah, like, we're all rednecks that, like, rode our horses to school. That's what everybody asks me. Yeah, they're like, did you ride a horse to school? I'm like, what?
But, you know, they like, I mean, yes, there are things that I dealt with, you know, in school, like, as somebody who is Jewish, that I probably wouldn't have had to have dealt with, you know, had I have gone to, you know, to high school or to middle school, even in Philadelphia.
Right.
But I think, like, there's these terrible sort of views, and, like, nobody, like, why would anybody want to live there? And I think, like, we need to stop segregating ourselves. And I think that's one of the huge problems. Like, if all the liberals move to the coast you know, and all the conservatives stay in the middle, we're always going to have this problem. And I think if we can get places like Amazon or, you know, Tesla or any of these, or, you know, like these large corporations to put, you know, their headquarters or like bring jobs to these areas that are losing, losing their source. I mean, like coal, come on, like coal's over. Like coal, it's on its way out. And, you know, that's really terrifying to people who rely on it. Like, what are they supposed to do? And there's, you know, yes, there are programs. You know, I did a postdoc in Kentucky and, you know, I would watch the news and they would talk about like, oh, we're going to bring coding. Like we're going to teach people in Kentucky to code and all that. But like the jobs need to be there. And if the jobs, you know, keep wanting to put their, you know, their headquarters in places that, you know, if you think that gentrification in San Francisco is a huge problem, right? Where the people who work in the city at the hotels and the restaurants can't afford to live there, but the people who live there are getting bussed by, you know, Facebook and whatever every day out to Mountain View, like, or to Google. Like, if you think
that's a problem,
well, one of the ways to do that is, you know, for those businesses not to be right there, right? To spread them out. And like I said, people don't agree with me on that. My husband doesn't agree with me on this, but like, I think that would be really helpful because then you're helping stimulate the economy in those areas. You're bringing jobs in those areas. You're bringing diversity into those areas, right? Because presumably, yes, you're going to hire some of the people who live in that area, but you're also going to be bringing people with you from different places. And that can only help foster, you know, learning about different people. So your experience with trans people or Black people or Hispanic people isn't just what you've seen on TV, you know, but like
you actually know people. I think that really speaks to the point that you were making before about openness, that there is this psychological construct, right, of these personality states or traits. And we typically think about the big five. That seems to be the one that has the best evidence to support it. Yeah. And openness to new experiences is one of the big five personality traits. And if you score high or even moderate to high on openness to new experiences, it is highly correlated with having you know, being interested in travel, having friends from various backgrounds, and having a more kind of, maybe even if it's not progressive per se, global worldview. You'd think about more than just the town you live in. And you think about the way that the world works. And you almost think about the world as being somewhat larger than you. But if you tend to be very closed to new experiences, there's a correlation there with like never having left home, not traveling much, maybe not being exposed to different groups of people with different ways of thinking. And obviously, I mean, when it comes down to it, I think we all know that this is one of the biggest problems that American society is facing. Like you said, is this tribalization, this more intensive segregation. Like weirdly, it almost feels like we're more segregated than we were when segregation was forced. And we're not from a, you know, a forced perspective, obviously, but we are, it's like we're choosing to be more segregated intentionally, right, which is, I think, really problematic. And just so that, because I feel like if I don't say it, I'm going to be mad at myself. That's really sort of the point that I was trying to make in my post about disenfranchisement, is that I was saying that probably the reason so many people feel, like you said, the colloquial version of the word disenfranchised, which I would actually rather say like disillusioned, or is that they have lost earning power. And I think what we see a lot is that poor, especially poor or or undereducated white Americans, especially white men living in like Rust Belt areas, feel like they no longer have the power to earn. And my point was that historically, welcome to what it was like for the rest of all of us. Yeah. So like being a woman, being a person of color, being an individual who historically was never had earning power. Not only were slaves working for free, that's the definition of slavery, is they were working without getting paid for their labor, but you know, women were discouraged or even prevented from having earning power. It was tied to marriage,
in some groups,
chattel slavery. Exactly. And so I think, as much as I'm like, yes, I am completely empathetic to the pain of feeling like your options have been taken away from you, there's also still a part of me that's like, you're just pissed because you finally feel what it's like for the rest of us.
Yeah.
And it's so hard for you that you can't even fucking handle it. Like, that's not okay.
Yeah. I can't remember where I heard it, but somebody said that, like, it's amazing when the loss of privilege feels like oppression. You know?
Yes, that's exactly. No, totally. I'm seeing that going around too. And that's exactly the sentiment that I was trying to make without it being like so pithy that people didn't even read into it. Like, right. You know, and this is really, when it comes down to it, a lot of what you do in SciComm or the science of science communication and in trying to understand conspiratorial thinking, anti-science or pseudoscientific thought, does it really come down to social science and persuasion science and marketing? I mean, is a lot of it really about how are we couching these things and how are we talking about them?
Yeah, both. So I'd say the understanding of why people are thinking the way they're thinking, because these groups that we're talking about that feel disillusioned, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The same groups that are believing the conspiracy theories, right?
Right. There's a lot of crossover there. You're right.
And, you know, it's that's all social science. So social psychology, cognitive psychology, you know, understanding the phenomenon and why it's happening is all social science. And then the sort of applied version of that, right? The marketing and advertising and even the PR type of methods are, you know, really that's the intervention. Like, how do we help fix this? So I worked under Kathleen Hall Jamieson at Annenberg.
Oh, very cool.
Mm-hmm. And also the co-creator of factcheck.org. And she would talk a lot. I think I heard her give at least like 4 or 5 talks about how they never should have referred to herd immunity. Like, that phrase herd immunity is terrible, right? She said it miscommunicates it. It makes people feel like cows. She said that we should have shifted to community immunity. And so she'll use
And that even rhymes. Yeah. Yeah. So much better.
But like, just word choice like that really just changes the way that people kind of perceive the issue. But you're also talking about it as like, you know, you're thinking about these communities. And if your community is not, you know, 95% vaccinated or whatever, like, it doesn't matter if US levels, right? So, you know, in the US, at least 5 years ago or whatever, when I last looked, you know, 98% of, you know, children in the US were vaccinated for MMR. So why do we have these outbreaks? Well, because it's not like equally distributed across the US, right?
Yeah, that's still a lot of people, 2% of the American population, especially if they're clustering.
Live together, right? So you have that happen to be in LA and North Dallas, right? And a couple of
just following me around my whole damn life.
Yeah. You know, of people who aren't doing this. And then you all of a sudden you're vulnerable because your community is vulnerable. And so, you know, just like those word choices, and that's straight out of PR. Right.
You're so right. I mean, it reminds me of like Medicare versus all, Medicare for all versus socialized medicine, or like death panels or death tax. And we've seen that like Republican strategists have been freaking awesome at this for like 40 years. Yeah. I mean, like, they've been really owning it. And for whatever reason, I do think that the Democratic counterpoint to that has not been as good at it. And I also think that in science, like in biomedical science, I shouldn't really say in public health, because I think public health are the people who are working really hard to change this, but we haven't been that good at it. Like, as scientists and even science communicators, we've always had this like kind of rise above mentality. Like, I don't have to market it because I have truth on my side. Right. And it's like, sorry, that's not working for you.
That's the way people think. So another friend of ours that we have in common, Alex Olshansky.
Yeah.
So I talked to Alex into doing our PhD program because he would like share I thought you knew this. Yeah.
So no, Alex, I mean, I just see him periodically on Facebook, which I'm not good at. So it's like, I always sort of am never on Facebook. And then once in a blue moon, I'll be like, who knew? Like, I'm always so excited when I see that people we went to school with like turned out. It's like they got out, or they like, you know,
something
had like a moral awakening in spite of some of the restrictions that we were dealing with. So, Alex, I'm like, hell yeah.
He's done all of the Flat Earth research with me. So
no way.
Alex, I he would, you know, again, post on Facebook all the time about science. And I was like, what are you doing? And he's like, I work at a bank. I'm like, why?
Yeah.
You know, like, why aren't you doing this? And I managed to talk him into like, you know, joining doing the PhD program. And so he graduates this year. He's like,
shut up. Alex is getting his PhD before me.
Alex is getting his PhD. And Kara, if you ever want to do yours with us, you know, let us know.
I'm like, I'm already a fourth year. I cannot switch gears at this point.
But you know, Alex has made a really great point about this sort of messaging, specifically with the use of the word socialism. Like, his parents escaped communist Russia, right?
Right.
Like, you know, back in the 70s. And, you know, it doesn't matter what their views are elsewise. Like, the fact that Fox News says Democrats are trying to push socialism is such a turnoff for his family. Like, they just, they can't, because the word
can't see past it. Yeah.
To what they experienced, you know, being oppressed in Russia as Jews. That's probably true too. I've heard some muttering about this, and I mean, I haven't done this work, but you know, they've been talking about in the news about, you know, like the Cuban population in Florida, like why, you know, some of these like Hispanic males have been voting for Trump. And they were worried that, you know, well, when you have immigrants that come to the US, you know, they're granted citizenship, they are afraid of the US becoming the kind of regimes that they have escaped from.
Yeah, absolutely. And you saw that even back in the Bush-Gore, you know, kerfuffle in Florida. It was post Elian Gonzalez. I just watched documentary about, you know, Florida being the nightmare state during the Bush-Gore campaign. And they tied almost everything back to Elian Gonzalez and becoming this poster child for... yeah, these anti-communist views and this like real fear, gripping fear that like the liberals wanted him to go back home. The liberals wanted to send him home. And the conservatives were like, no, he needs to stay here where he'll be free and he can thrive. And that caused a massive divide in the Cuban community.
That's so interesting. But I mean, and it doesn't matter if Bernie Sanders and, you know, AOC try to rebrand this as democratic socialism, or they try to link it to, well, this is what's going on in Canada. You know, this is very different than the kind of socialism that you're talking about from these autocratic countries. It doesn't matter. Like, it's still got there.
It's a tainted word. Yeah. It's the same reason that you can't use a swastika in your Chinese art anymore. Like, we know that it predates the Nazis, but they kind of ruined it.
Exactly. That's exactly what I was going to say. You know, at this point, so maybe if you've been living in the US or your family's been here for a long time, you're not thinking about, like, socialism seems like it's such a, you know, long way away from anything you thought about, especially the younger generations. But for older generations who, you know, had dealt with, I mean, this word has a very specific connotation to it. And so we really, you know, even if you want to adopt democratic socialist policies, we need to rebrand that, you know?
I don't know. Have you seen Climate Hustle and Climate Hustle 2?
I have not. No.
So they're garbage. But I recommend that you watch them because of the work that you do, because they're like these brilliant and beautiful examples of just propaganda perfectly packaged. And it taps into all the things we've been talking about, like really elevating people's individual fears of socialism, people's individual fears of, like I said, a new world order, or like the government having too much control over your life, and somehow enveloping other ideologies inside of these fears, like repackaging things so that they're all tainted by those fears, which I think is such a brilliant strategy.
So
like it works.
There's a person in our kind of area of research, who has been tracking climate denial over time. Like he does a little bit of like historical work, and he said that, you can see, this is my favorite link. So he's found a direct connection between anti-climate views in the conservative political area and the fall of the Soviet Union. Mm. So with the fall of the Soviet Union, political conservatives needed a new boogeyman.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really at the same time, you had a rise in conservative think tanks. You had sort of pushes in this anti-environmentalism movement. And they connected the red rhetoric to environmentalism.
They're like in this documentary, they do it beautifully. They have like the former president or premier of the Czech Republic, basically like warning us that we're entering into an environmental authoritarian state.
Yeah. And there's some great figures where you can look at not the general population, but you can look at congressional voting in both houses, Congress and the Senate, for pro-environment. And you see that it's basically like, I mean, yes, there's a divide. There's a little divide because, you know, you're talking about government regulation and there's always going to be a difference between political conservatives and political liberals on that. But right at 1990, you see this, you know, 1990, 1991, you see this split. It just like totally opens up and starts polarizing really strongly. And he had a piece of propaganda that was sort of like, to borrow the missing link sort of thing, where he said environmentalists are like watermelons. They're green on the outside, but then you like cut it open and it's red on the inside and they have like the hammer and sickle on it. And it works. Yeah. It connects, you know, environmentalism, which should not be linked at all somehow to like communism. Like, you know, how did you get there from here?
Right.
Other than you're talking about, you know, some government regulation, but it really, that link just, it wasn't helpful, right?
Right. So I know that it's like a little later where you are and it's almost dinner time, but I was wondering if I could keep you a tiny bit longer because I have two things I want to get into with you. Okay. So the second thing is I want to get into your work with Flat Earthers a little bit more because I'm super interested in your findings. But the first thing is that I'd love to kind of get your take as somebody who really studies these this sort of mental gymnastics and the worldviews and like how people stay in their own echo chambers and, you know, why people believe what they believe. This, what I think of as almost like a new incarnation, or maybe it's just a better incarnation of the sort of 1984 newspeak, where like Trump has really mastered doublespeak in that he's very good at taking something that has a real definition and turning it into the opposite of what it is to serve his political agenda. And somehow people just eat it up. I mean, the best example is fake news, right? Like instead of something actually being fake news, it's just any real news that's critical of him, he calls fake news. And then there's a large proportion of the population that jumps on the bandwagon. And now, you know, massive distrust has been sowed in legitimate nonpartisan media. And you see it with a lot of different types of arguments where like he's being investigated for financial crimes. And so he'll be like, no, that guy is the guy who's doing the bad thing. Like when he was investigated with ties to Russia, he's like, no, Hunter Biden. And you see this kind of happening left and right, and it works. And it's amazing to me that that would work because it seems so obvious on its surface when you're like, okay, that's doublespeak though. No, he's just saying the opposite of what's true.
Yes.
Like yeah. How, I mean, we knew, like, obviously George Orwell knew it worked because he wrote about it in his dystopian future novel. And like, we've seen this with like Aldous Huxley and with different kind of mid-century sci-fi novelists who saw that this is a means of social control. But it's like, I don't know. It always seemed like it would work on paper to me, but like real people would be able to see right through it. Yeah.
I think if you start from the premise that people don't know who you are and you just like walk into a room and you start double speaking, I don't think anybody would take you seriously. I think you have
right.
It has to be consistent with your worldview and it allows you to deflect.
Right. You know? So he's tapping into something that's already there. And I think that's something that a lot of people forget with Trump. Like, yes, Trump is a problem. He's not the problem. Without him, there probably wouldn't be a coalescing. Like he is definitely codifying and unifying and centralizing, but he is codifying and unifying and centralizing a worldview that predates him.
Yes. Yeah. No. Exactly. Yeah. I mean, he's saying things that have been echoed by, you know, former conservative leaders in the U.S. as well as by fascist leaders in other countries. It's just to what extent takes it. But no, I mean, I really would say like. I don't think it's the doublespeak specifically. I think it really is just sort of going back to that mechanism of motivated reasoning. And, you know, it's a distraction technique. So, you know, people aren't questioning what he's doing. They're focused on somebody else doing it. But it also, I think, kind of gives people this view that he's a strong leader. And, you know, I got really worried when they were talking about the election results and they said that, you know, the largest proportion of people when asked what was most important to them in the president in, you know, the exit polls was a strong leader.
Yeah, that does not bode well.
Yeah. And it's not that Biden isn't a strong leader. It's that we know colloquially what they mean. It's just like, if you hear the phrase family values, you know, you don't really mean like the definition of family values. You mean Christian, right?
Yeah. You don't mean like watching Disney movies with your kids. Right. You mean like no gay people should have kids.
Sort of
yeah.
like up in this and strong leader has been something that, you know, that sort of brought up with this, like, you know, autocratic sort of bullying type of.
Yeah. Authoritarian. Yeah.
Half. So.
It's so scary. No, but I mean, I guess
fascinating that he does it and that somehow it works. And, you know, they constantly talk about it on the news, how, you know, the Trump administration has never hid what it's done. They've always said explicitly what they were doing. But the thing, one of the things that I've noticed is that Trump says all the things. So while Trump is also saying that, you know, people shouldn't have to wear masks, then he says, but masks might be good, but oh, they might also be bad. And then he's sending out an email that says patriots wear masks, but then he's saying that people shouldn't have to wear masks. So like you can pick, I mean, he's like the Rorschach, he says all the things. And so you can just find whichever example of what he said you agree with and then move with that.
Because and like, then he has a debate strategy to say, no, I said this.
Right. He always, yeah. And so people can, you know, there's a lot of people in, you know, back in our hometown who would post on their Facebook walls, like vote party, not person. Right. But they'll always be able to deflect and say, well, he doesn't really mean that. Does he? Does he not really mean that? Well, I mean, he said four different things, so he clearly.
Yeah. So it's kind of impossible to know
anything. So I think that allows people to kind of pick and choose from what he says to support. And you know, maybe that is a brilliant, you know, communication strategy.
It's scary that it works, though. I mean, I think the part that really gets me is this, like, and I promise you, I'm not saying this out of like the Schadenfreude of the day, and I'm not saying this just to denigrate. I'm saying it because I literally have struggled with this and mean it. But this very juvenile strategy that sort of directly translates to like, I know you are, but what am I?
Right.
Like that is his. Not his platform, but his argumentation strategy, and it works. And to me, it's just like, no, if you can see past your five-year-old doing that, like literally pointing to his sister while he has cookie crumbs all over his face saying she did it.
Right.
How can you not see that the president of the United States is doing that? That's the part I struggle with. But I mean, you're right. It's motivated reasoning.
Yeah, no, I really think that. And the other part of it, I think that there's so much anger. And I'll say in part, so one of the things we were talking about a bit earlier about like trying to mix everybody up a bit, you know, it's not to indoctrinate people, but so you actually know somebody who has a conflicting view, right?
Yeah.
And you talk to that person. And so you recognize that that person's like not a Satanist or a member of a Satanist cult. Like, you know, there's... That you have, I totally forgot where I was going with this.
That's okay. It happens to me all the fucking time. That's why.
Yeah. So, you know, you just have people with different views. They're, you know, you're talking about, what was I going to say about that?
Yeah. Or, like, so you're exposed to people of different views. And then what were we're talking about? I'm rubber, you're glue. No, not I'm rubber, you're glue. Yeah. I know you are, but what am I?
Yeah, I remember. Okay.
Yeah, okay.
So you're exposed to people who have different views. You recognize that liberals aren't a bunch of Satanist members of Satanist cults. You don't see them as the actual enemy, but there's a huge movement within Trump supporters that, you know, Don Jr., when he was speaking, I don't remember if it was election night or the night right after, you know, he was saying that we have to support Donald Trump, not just because of his policies, but because he also like, I can't remember if he says like angers the libs or
he gets under our skin. So that's a good thing.
Right. Like
that's, you know, not good.
Pushes back. He fights against them. So people see him as like a warrior against that. So.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, you know, it's like we're always going to be divided if we elect representatives who run on those platforms. I really am interested in getting to a place politically where there's a mutual respect, where there's sort of like a gentle person. I don't want to say gentleman, but like a gentle person's sort of agreement that even if we disagree politically, we're going to work together. We have similar goals, which is to care for the entire constituency, not just my personal constituency. And I think that that will be healing. And the part that frustrates me is that I kind of feel like sometimes I see it in certain politicians, and then I see other politicians who are absolutely not interested in it. And those politicians do better because they like rile people up better.
Yeah, no, exactly. Fear mongering.
Yeah. Like anger, like, you know, sowing distrust, sowing anger. And these lead downstream to the things that you study. Like, for example, you've done this. Can you tell me a little bit about what you did? Like, what was your study with the flat earthers? Like, what did you investigate and how'd you go about it?
So, one of the things when I was doing, I started to do some conspiracy theory work when I was in grad school. But one of the things that I realized was that the demographic, because I was curious, like many might be, about which political ideology is more conspiracy theory minded, right? Mm-hmm. But what I found that was so interesting, it was not the, you know, and this, of course, this was not a national, when I started doing this, this was not nationally representative populations. This was just, college students. But what was correlated, the demographic characteristic correlated most strongly with conspiracy endorsement was not telling me your demographic characteristic. So if you didn't, support your political ideology, if you didn't say what gender you were, if you refused to give me your age. And
which makes sense because you're already probably really distrustful.
Right, exactly. So I was thinking like all of these nationally representative studies measuring conspiracy theory endorsement, what are the chances that they're actually talking to conspiracy theorists, right? Mm. Or are they looking at normative levels of conspiracy endorsement among the general population, right? Like not actually conspiracy theorists. So I'm like, how do you get to talk to conspiracy theorists? Well, and then Alex and I saw that the Flat Earthers were going to have a conference and we're like, okay, we have to go to this, right? So we interviewed Flat Earthers at the conference in Raleigh and mm-hmm. then we did it again in Denver and talked to them about their views and their beliefs and you know, really originally I was going to, because I wanted to understand their mental models. But, you know, we learned a lot about, you know, how strongly it correlates with other conspiracy beliefs, how most of them were white males. That wasn't true of everybody, but that was true for a lot. How there were people there who had graduate level education, mostly engineers and medical professionals. And, you know, it was just really fascinating. And I think like, you know, one, there was some rumor dispelling for me. You know, the view I went in with like, oh, these are people who are probably, no, many of them very, very much were biblical literalists.
Okay.
And I think because that really deals well with that worldview, but it wasn't like a undereducated, I mean, the education's really varied, but it was a YouTube community. You know, people started by watching other conspiracy videos and then they wanted to debunk the flat earth video. So they would watch it and they would try to debunk it. And then they felt like the arguments were so compelling. They continued to do their own research and mm-hmm. and found that this made more sense to them given their worldviews than other stories. Their view of the scientific community is very interesting. The examples, I mean, they have examples from, you know, times where science has not done good things, you know, that does exist. And they really glom onto that. And, you know, I think it, well, the other thing that was interesting was they were like, well, you know, scientists aren't trustworthy. Scientists are evil, blah, blah, blah. Not you guys who are talking to us, but, and that's because they were getting to know us, you know?
Yeah. It's always, that's the case. You see it a lot with racist ideology, right? Yeah. It's like every racist person I know has like a black friend, but instead of saying, this is an interesting opening to me understanding more about the African-American experience, what they're really saying is this guy's the exception to the rule. Everybody else is, you know, whatever my racist views are, but this person is the exception. So he's cool.
No, exactly. And yeah, but I mean, so we did, I think, you know, we have one paper that Alex is first author on, that talks about, you know, flat earth ideology as a religion, and mm-hmm. the different kind of characteristics of it. But not in the sense that again, like they don't have a specific belief other than the belief that what you're told is false. But then we did some with, like a general population with the Flat Earth videos and found that, you know, of people who were a little higher on conspiracy mentality, you know, they were open to researching Flat Earth after seeing one Flat Earth video. And so and this is part of what got me really interested too in digital video. There's sort of a fluency of argumentation. Like, even if you're not actually making good arguments, it gives you the feeling that there are good arguments. And so there's something there for the spread of misinformation, but also how useful of a tool it is for, for science education. But interestingly, we see a huge gender divide on engagement with science video. And so that,
Do you think that's partly just simply a function of the platform, that YouTube historically has a big gender divide, and that a lot of most of YouTube is like gaming videos?
Well,
it really is. Like, it breaks the algorithm. Like, there's so many gaming videos on YouTube that they algorithmically can't let them all be at the top, because that's all you would think YouTube was.
That's so funny.
Yeah.
We took the videos off of the platform and tested, participants' likelihood of agreeing to watch a video in an experimental setting, and we still had a gender gap between men.
Interesting. Oh, yeah, that's fascinating. I wonder that too about podcasting and about like some of these other platforms as well. I struggle to get enough women to listen to my podcast, even though more than half of my guests are women, and I'm a woman, and I talk about feminism on the show, but I'm still, I think, 80%, 75% of my listenership is male.
Yeah, and that's true of like Physics Girl on Digital Studios. The question is, well, the percent that is woman, would they be there if you weren't kind of a woman yourself? Like maybe
right. If this was a male channel only interviewing male researchers and authors, like, wow.
So that's the question. It's like, where's the female audience? And, is it a platform thing? Is it, just video in general? Maybe it's not YouTube, but maybe it's digital video. Maybe it's YouTube and podcasting. One of the things that we think might be important is the instrumental versus like curiosity satisfying goals. So, women may feel more guilty about just doing something for the sake of satisfying their curiosity. It has to have some sort of instrumental.
Gotcha. So unless I'm doing good for my family, or I'm I'm actively like bettering myself, or whatever.
Yeah. If their videos are like health oriented, then we tend to see an uptick. But what's interesting is that the relationship between science interest or science curiosity and their likelihood of watching the video decreases when we do that. So it seems to be less of a curiosity motivating or a curiosity satisfying motivation than an instrumental one. And so, this is still very early and we're still really digging into this, but I think that...
There's a lot there. That's fascinating. Like, there's a lot to unpack there, because it makes me, we always kind of try to put ourselves against these models. So I'm thinking, like, is this why I don't like listening to podcasts? Because it feels like I'm just doing more work. Yeah. Like, I don't want to have to do more work, but I don't see listening to podcasts as a way to escape or as a way to enjoy myself. I see it as work, which I don't have time for.
Right. Yeah, no. And so that's, that's why we really want to do some more of this research, and I've applied for some grants, and hopefully we'll get to continue to do that. But yeah, because to me it seems like, that's a huge digital divide, because the more the more that men are exposing themselves to science learning opportunities, then we're gonna, and women aren't specifically doing that, then we're likely to see a widening gap in women's interest in and engagement with, and even like choosing to follow or pursue science careers.
Yeah. And SciComm is like almost exclusively following a sort of social media, video, podcast, blogging platform. Like, yes, there are SciCommers that work in like the museum space and that do public events, but the vast majority of like independently successful sort of self-employed SciCommers are, hosting podcasts or doing a video series on TikTok or, whatever it might be.
Yeah, social media is a platform. Social media is a huge platform, even for the organizations that haven't relied on it exclusively, like PBS.
Yeah.
You're right. So
interesting. There's so much here. I was just thinking as we were talking, and I never get a chance to plug this, so I'm glad that I get to during our conversation. I recently, like maybe about a year ago, worked on a multi-part series called Pulling the Thread, which is a short form documentary series about conspiracy thought. And it was produced by the Kindling Group, funded by ITV, and aired on World Channel, which so different PBS affiliates might have it available on theirs, but you can also just find it on YouTube. And it's a, I think five, let me see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. I don't even remember. It's 6 parts. And we dig into some of the different reasonings. And so like one episode talks about exactly the question you were asking as well, like which political party is most guilty of endorsing conspiracy theories. And whereas in your study, you were finding that it's actually higher, like correlated more highly with people who refuse to tell you in a lot of the research that they looked into, but this was all prior to 2016. And there is some good, good reasons to think that things are a little bit different post 2016. But prior to 2016, it actually more highly correlated with whatever party lost.
Oh, interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. So whoever was not in power was more likely to turn to theories that explained these losses and rallied the bases. And then we talked about like triggers, you know, patternicity, confirmation bias, all these different mental reasonings. We talked about prudent versus extreme paranoia. So exactly what you mentioned, this idea that like, you know, if African-Americans are more suspicious of doctors than the rest of the country, and they're more likely to believe in conspiracy theories about HIV, isn't there a good reason for that? Because of Tuskegee trials, because of significant institutionalized racism in American healthcare. And so where do you draw that line between being prudent and being paranoid? And just like a lot of these different topics, which I think are really important for people to dig into, to get a better understanding of like why people think this way, and that not all conspiracy theorists are like your uncle in the tinfoil hat.
Right.
Like they're shades of conspiracy. They're not all Alex Jones.
Right. Well, QAnon, I think, has really sort of lifted on, you know, evangelicals, women's concern about, you know, child trafficking.
Yes. So absolutely. Like we all agree that child trafficking, like that sex trafficking is not okay, right? That human trafficking in general is not okay. But what we don't agree on is the fact that like this isn't actually even happening within the Democratic Party.
Somehow like Wayfair, it was like selling cabinets with kids in it and the Democratic mechanical. I mean, but you know, it starts off with something that seems perfectly, you know, of course we can all get behind, and then kind of goes from there.
Absolutely. And it also, I think we did one of our episodes was about Alex Jones and his claims that Sandy Hook never happened. Yeah. And we dug into how could a person not only say that in good conscience, but how could so many people believe that? Because he had a massive following that believed it and were like harassing the parents of these children who had died. I mean, it was atrocious. And the psychologists that were interviewed and the different individuals that had looked into this phenomenon kind of came to the conclusion that it's highly likely that we come up with these stories, these myths, because they seem more palatable than the truth. Like the idea that the world could be so dangerous and chaotic that our children in a place where they're meant to be safe, our little tiny children, could be slaughtered so readily is harder to swallow than the fact that this was all made up.
Yeah. I mean, that's definitely one reason. I think also, you know, if you believe that gun, like if you're concerned about gun legislation, it's
right. You know, there's that motivated reasoning again.
That's what I'm always going to fall back on.
I love it though, but it's so true. I mean, it's like, I always talk about confirmation bias. Like my confirmation bias is your motivated reasoning. Cause as a scientific skeptic, they're all part of the same thing.
Yeah, a phenomenon.
And they underlie, it's like, that's the bias of all biases. Like all the other biases are built on that bias.
It's like, you know, so in my second postdoc, we studied this from like a Bayesian perspective. And if you think about it, it makes total sense that this is how we reason, right? We have existing schemas and we compare every kind of bit of evidence that we come into contact with against what exists. And if it's consistent with it, right, then we adjust or update or whatever, right? So we're constantly comparing information to what we know and understand. That is motivated reason, you know.
Yeah,
it is confirmation bias. Like it doesn't make sense if you think that Trump is a superhero, right? If you think that he's amazing and he is fighting for your, you know, your views, then you know the idea that he could, you know, be inclusion with Russia, like, just doesn't make sense, right? You know, any more than it makes sense to us that Hillary Clinton could actually be selling kids from a you know, a pizza restaurant. Like it just doesn't make sense. So now you might argue one is true and one is not, but that's it's the same reasoning pathway.
Right. And it reminds me of like the classic kind of, I think it was David Dunning who, you know, of the Dunning-Kruger effect, who has this amazing quote, and I'm going to have to paraphrase because I tried to Google it and I can't find it right away, about the fact that like, we don't have blank slates. Like when new knowledge comes in, it's not replacing something old, or it's not moving into an empty space. It's like you said, connecting to all the other stuff that's there. And if it doesn't feel like it fits, we're going to make it fit.
Exactly.
Like it's going to fit one way or another. And that's why sometimes it amazes us when we see somebody who receives disconfirming evidence and yet it bolsters their claims. And you're like, what kind of mental gymnastics were involved in that? But right. They didn't even try. It's a natural human phenomenon.
Right. Or they can just dismiss it. So with the Pope talking about, you know, climate change, and you have a bunch of white Catholics who don't believe that climate change is a real issue, or at least that it's not problematic or human caused. Well, now they're like, well, the Pope shouldn't talk about things that are outside of his expertise. The Pope shouldn't be getting into political arguments, only, you know, papal ones. Like, okay, can we not list anything else that he feels that way about?
And also like, who's making this political?
Yeah.
But yes, yes, agree. Well, gosh, Ashley, there's like, I want to talk to you again. Hopefully we can schedule another one maybe next year to like continue the conversation, because there's so much more and I want to know about all the new research that you're doing. But okay. I've also kept you for an hour and a half, and I would be really bummed if I didn't ask you my last two questions that I ask everybody who comes on the show, because honestly, more than usual, I'm really fascinated to hear what your answers are to these last two questions. You ready? They're kind of big picture questions.
Oh, okay. I'm ready.
Sorry. All right. So when you think about the future in whatever context is relevant to you, and I know it's weird because like your work is amazing, but also like there's this, the election results just came in today. There's a lot going on. So like in whatever context feels personal and relevant to you, number one, what is the thing that's keeping you up the most at night, like legitimately concerning you? Maybe you're sort of pessimistic, even borderline cynical about. And then on the flip side of that, to kind of end on a more, I guess, hopeful note, what are you genuinely and like authentically optimistic about and looking forward to?
So generally concerned about social media.
Okay.
You know, the algorithms that social media, specifically things like Twitter and Facebook, employs are perfect for advertising. I mean, they make so much sense. I would much rather, you know, see an advertisement for shoes from Nordstrom's than for erectile dysfunction medication, right? Like, I'm so glad that it can make recommendations based on my prior activity, right? Mm-hmm. Even if it means that something's going to follow me around for a while after I've looked at it once. However, those same algorithms should not be applied to our news environment. And that's what's so problematic. So posts that we have, I mean, people are living in their own information bubbles, which means that what we think is true about the world is very different than what other people think is true about the world because of what they're constantly being exposed to. And that leads to things like, you know, frustration and chaos. And now it's possible that the more we talk about the issue of echo chambers and social media, the more people will understand that they're in a bubble and that maybe they'll try to do things like watch opposing television channels or, you know, purposefully go to specific locations for news as opposed to, you know, just rely on what's on their feed. But so many people aren't going to do that, that I think it's really screwing with, you know, how we conceive of reality.
Mm-hmm.
That's what's really concerning.
Yeah.
What's really hopeful, I guess, that, you know, we have a lot of people working on these issues. And, you know, there's areas of science communication and political communication and, you know, that people are coming around to this. And I think, you know, hopefully we'll, you know, and there's organizations too that are putting money behind it, you know, grants that are trying to help that I think really might help benefit our country as a whole. But I hope we figure it out soon, because I really do think that this is a huge issue.
You said it, and you've got so much expertise in these areas that I think it's important that you're saying those things as well, coming from somebody who knows what's up. So Ashley, I learned so much talking to you. I think that this was a really important chat, especially like right now to be having. So I thank you for giving us so much of your time, for being so generous with your time, and for joining me on the show this week.
Thank you, Kara.
Of course. And everybody listening, thank you for coming back week after week. I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.